My name is Phil Engstrom, and this is the group to consider the book Small is Beautiful. In the June 27th issue of the Christian Science Monitor, there was an article which had as a heading, "What do Elliot Richardson, Jerry Rubin, Ralph Nader, and Jerry Brown have in common? When E.F. Schumacher talks, they listen." And then the article goes on to present a kind of a summary of the work of this German economist and describes something of his point of view about economics as if people counted. E.F. Schumacher, as I said, is a German economist. And in 1930, he went to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar to study economics. And by the time he was 22 years of age, he was teaching at Columbia University in economics. He spent some time doing that, and then he began to move around a bit. He became a farmer for a while. He was a businessman for a while, a journalist for a time, and then he became the chairman of the National Coal Board in England, which is one of the most powerful organizations in England having to do with industry and its problems. And likewise, he was also involved in the reconstruction of Germany after the war. So he's had a wide range of experience in a number of different areas. In 1973, he came out with the book Small is Beautiful, appropriately small, and in that includes a number of essays. But first, I'd like to go back to this article from the Monitor and just read a few samples of his philosophy or his point of view. He says, "The modern economist is used to measuring the standard of living by the amount of annual consumption, assuming all the time that a man who consumes more is better off than the man who consumes less. A Buddhist economist would consider this approach excessively irrational, since consumption is merely a means of human well-being. The aim should be to obtain the maximum of well-being with the minimum of consumption." Then on being misunderstood, "People think I want to take their technological toys away. I have no such intention. I was talking in Germany and had a big audience. And after my talk, I walked out. Behind me was an enraged couple. And the woman said, 'What stupid stuff this guy was talking about. Do you know he arrived by airplane? How could he come by airplane if we only had intermediate technology?' Well, this was too much for me. And with the utmost politeness, I turned around and said, 'Madam, in that case, there would be no need for me to come at all.'" And then on Schumacher and shoemakers, "I can speak from authority on the subject of making technology fit because my name is that of a shoemaker. It is not good enough to make excellent shoes. It is necessary that the shoes fit. It is not good enough to make them bigger and bigger. One has to consider the needs of the little people, and that we have totally forgotten. The task is not to abolish the big steelworks. They will abolish themselves. The dinosaurs collapsed under their own weight. The task is to find the middle area of technology so that we have shoes to fit every size of foot. And here's a rather humorous one about the communist countries. This fascination with things, the bigger the better, has little to do with communism and capitalism. It is a universal trait of all civilization. Not so long ago, I was in East Germany, and they were giving a very pungent description of what they thought about Western economics. And at one point, one of them said, "The Western economies are like an express train, moving at an ever-increasing speed straight into an abyss. But we shall overtake them." And this is one facet of Schumacher's work that I find much appeal in, working with your hands. People ask me how we got into such a technological predicament. I put a lot down to the snobbiness of our education, a special kind of snobbiness, namely, to work with the brain is more worthy than to work with the hands. St. Thomas Aquinas said, "The human being is a being of brain and hands. With hands, we can learn a great deal and keep in touch with reality. It's only when you don't work with your hands anymore than you have to, it's only when you don't work with your hands anymore than you have to think, it's only when you don't work with your hands anymore that you don't have to think small and can let your brain run wild." In other words, working with our hands sort of keeps our brains restricted, in a sense, and gives them some perspective. If we never work with our hands, we let our imaginations roam. That's all right in itself, but we begin to propose all kinds of things that are unrealistic for human beings to live with, ultimately. And this theme of mind and hand is quite a strong dominant theme in much that Schumacher says. He is coming out with a new book this September, Guide for the Perplexed by Harper and Row. So if you do like what Schumacher says, you might pick up that when it comes out in September. Now, as I said, this is a collection of essays, and I don't know how to review a collection of essays except to pick out a few of them and try to highlight what is said in those few and hopefully encourage others of you who perhaps have not read the book to pick up a copy and look through it, because I do think it is a significant book. I ought to inject a disclaimer. I'm not an economist, and economics to me is a mystery. So I'm not trying to report on this as an economist. But many of his themes are, I think, profoundly Christian. He is a Roman Catholic and draws at various places on his Christian faith in trying to understand the predicament that he sees ourselves in presently. I think there are three principal enemies that Schumacher has. One of them is Keynesian economics, which he refers to quite frequently, the economics of John Maynard Keynes, a well-known British economist. Second enemy is big technology. He's not against technology, but he's against big technology and unrestricted industrial growth. And thirdly, unlimited economic growth. He sees no point in the continual amassing of greater and greater wealth on the part of anyone. Now, his essays range rather widely. So I'll just pick out a few that to me were somewhat interesting and try to review those. One of the early ones is on peace and unlimited growth. He sees these as contradictory kinds of ideas. He says that the dominant idea, or one of the dominant ideas found today, is that a sound foundation for peace is unrestricted growth and universal, that universal prosperity would lead to peace. That would be stating it better. If somehow we can make everyone reasonably wealthy so that they have all the basic needs of life, then the danger of war will be past. Well, at this point, he goes back to John Maynard Keynes, who is in a sense his favorite target, I think. And Keynes does not seem to feel that this is necessary. His point of view is that there will be a time in the future when all people will enjoy prosperity. Everyone. There need be no restriction. But in the intervening time, there will have to be a period when unrestricted questing for wealth on the part of a few shall be allowed and indeed encouraged. Might read the selection. That's right. That's his point of view. So, for example, no, he doesn't say that. No, this is Keynes speaking. So, this is a paraphrase. We shall then, Keynes said, once more, that is in the future, value ends above means and prefer the good to the useful. But beware, he continued, the time for all this is not yet. For at least another 100 years, we must pretend to ourselves and to everyone that fair is foul and foul is fair. For foul, and by that he means avarice, greed, the unlimited quest for wealth, is useful, and fair is not. Avarice and usury and precaution must be our gods for a little longer still. For only they can lead us out of the tunnel of economic necessity into daylight. So after this 100 years of letting greed and avarice have their freedom, then we will come to a time of prosperity for everyone. Schumacher says this is a profoundly false point of view and ultimately destructive. Because we cannot decide what is enough. We cannot decide where the line shall be drawn and what we mean by sufficiently wealthy. That was after the Great Fall in 1930. That was around 1930, after the Great Fall. Yeah. But Schumacher says that many modern economists are still following this line and still hold pretty much. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think that Schumacher would agree that there's no way in which you can say just when this point of adequate prosperity has arrived. And
he's saying the trouble with that point of view, with Keynes' point of view, is that you can never tell when you reach that point.
Well, that's. Yes, that's one point he makes. He also, of course, attacks greed and avarice themselves and says that these are intrinsically evil and the allowance of them cannot possibly lead to anything virtuous in the future. You cannot bypass virtue in the hope of someday achieving a good. The ends don't justify the means, in other words. The word to the poor presently is be patient. Don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg, because if you let the wealthy nations increase their wealth without limit, then they will somehow pull all the poor with them and everyone's level will be raised to a good level in in some bright future.
What would he say about Jesus' statement, the poor you always have with you?
He doesn't comment on that in the book. I think he would agree with that, that there'll always be some poor in the world. But he doesn't see the present economics as coping with the problems of the poor in an effective way at all. Now, it's very difficult to measure who's poor and who's rich. So as a kind of a yardstick, he says, let's take the notion of energy. The access of a person to energy is one way of deciding the person's wealth. And energy is a very crucial thing in society and an obvious necessity for the maintenance of life. So as a yardstick, he says that we will call all of those who consume more than one metric ton equivalent of coal per year wealthy, and those who consume less than that poor. Now, with this very arbitrary way of defining poor and rich, he goes on to say that according to 1966 figures, the average rich person, by this definition in 1966, used 4.52 metric tons of coal per year. And the average poor used 0.32. So the difference there is a factor of 14. The average rich person used 14 times as much energy as did the defined poor person. And 7/10 of the world, by this definition, is poor. If the poor use as much energy as the rich, the energy consumption would jump instantly to 3 times its present use. So he points a finger at those of us who are rich, and that, by his definition, would be all of us, and says that, we are stripping the world of its wealth. Economic growth, he claims, has no built-in factor that limits itself. And that is its flaw. So on one page here, page 23, he says, I have taken fuel merely as an example to illustrate a very simple thesis, that economic growth, which viewed from the point of view of economics, physics, chemistry, and technology, has no discernible limit and must necessarily run into decisive bottlenecks when viewed from the point of the environmental scientist. An attitude to life which seeks fulfillment in the single-minded pursuit of wealth, in short, materialism, does not fit into this world because it contains within itself no limiting principle, while the environment in which it is placed is strictly limited. And then goes on to speak about the way in which environment is now speaking to us and telling us how it is suffering. So then the foundation of peace, he says, is not found in universal prosperity as it's presently conceived. Foul is useful, fair is not. For such prosperity is attainable only by cultivating greed, envy, and these are intrinsically destructive. And then he brings in the notion of wisdom. You don't find that very much in modern literature. You don't find the word wisdom appearing very often, but he says that's the thing that's crucially lacking in modern economics. And he says the central concept of wisdom is permanence. Nothing is wise if its continuance leads to an ultimate absurdity. And he claims that the allowance of greed and avarice eventually lead to an absurdity. Permanence is incompatible with the predatory attitude expressed in the statement, what were luxuries for our fathers are necessities for us. That's an interesting observation, I think. And then another quote from Dorothy Sayers, whom some of you have been looking into recently. War is a judgment, says Dorothy L. Sayers, that to overtake societies when they have been living upon ideas that conflict too violently with the laws governing the universe. Never think that wars are irrational catastrophes. They happen when wrong ways of thinking and living bring about intolerable situations. And the wrong way of living and thinking is summed up in this notion of unlimited economic growth and the allowance of greed and avarice to have unbridled existence, and indeed to encourage them in our advertising and in our mores and in our society in many sorts of ways.
How about the scriptural exhortation? Owe no man anything save to love them.
Yes. I think Schumacher would like that. You know? How do we find the strength to overcome greed and avarice? Here he goes to Gandhi. You'll find in his writing a lot of drawing from many religious sources, not only Christian, but Oriental, Buddhist, and so on. So, in quoting Gandhi, he says the following, or rather, he asks the question, where can one find the strength to overcome the violence of greed, envy, hate, and lust within oneself? I think Gandhi has given the answer. There must be recognition of the existence of the soul apart from the body and of its permanent nature. And this recognition must amount to a living faith, and in the last resort, nonviolence does not avail those who do not possess a living faith in the God of love. Well, that's enough for his section on peace and prosperity. Another essay that's rather interesting is one on Buddhist economics. Someone asked him why he called this essay Buddhist economics instead of Christian economics, since he's a Roman Catholic. And he said, well, if I did that, nobody would read it. So. Now all the Christians are curious, and they read the chapter and learn what...
No, it's for the non-Christians. They wouldn't read it.
Maybe he wrote a chapter, Christian Economics, for the Buddhists.
Right.
I don't know. But the theme of this this essay is that of work. Fundamental source of wealth, he says, everyone knows, is work. Even Adam and Eve could not have sat on their veranda and expected the apples and oranges to roll onto the veranda. They had to go out into the Garden of Eden to pick their fruit. And there's no way in which we can acquire wealth except by investing labor. We don't go to the printing press and manufacture money and call that wealth. That's a ridiculous idea. Well, that's the way it sometimes seems that it all happens. There's no way to get around this. Everyone knows that the only way to wealth is through labor and through work. And yet, he claims, modern economists regard labor as little more than a necessary evil. From the point of view of economists today, labor is a cost item and therefore must be reduced. Work requires sacrifice of leisure and comfort. And since leisure and comfort are the ultimate goods, work is bad, and we compensate the laborer for this sacrifice of his labor, of his leisure and comfort. And the ideal of the employer today, in many cases, he says, is to have output without employees. But the employees have bought this idea as well. And the ideal for the employee is to have income without employment. And here he brings in the notion of Buddhist idea of work. And there are three principles that are very important to the Buddhist. First of all, work gives man a chance to utilize and develop his faculties. There's no way we can understand our own talents and capabilities unless we work. If we simply sit in our armchairs and reflect on the universe and never use our hands, we shall never know what talents lie within us. No way. Second important aspect of work for the Buddhist is that it enables him to overcome egocentricity. We can live a fairly selfish life if we are the employee who gets the paycheck without employment. But if we have to go into the labor market and work at a workbench with someone else, we must necessarily come to grips with our own selfishness. And we must necessarily learn somehow to overcome our tendencies to selfishness. If we have to stand at a workbench with someone else and work with him, we must necessarily learn how to share. There's no way that you can get around that completely. You will have to somehow confront at least your own selfishness if you're working with someone else. It enables man, a person, to overcome his egocentricity and to think more in terms of other people. If your fellow worker gets hurt, you are there and you are confronted with your responsibility as a person to him. If you do not enter the labor market, if you at no time in your life engage in work, you could possibly escape much of this. You will not see the hurt of the world. And you will not see the pain that others suffer when, the person who is, let's say, lives off of inherited wealth only and does not. Yes, yeah.
You're using work in the broadest sense. Rather than employed.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he doesn't specify it here, but I would suspect he means that. Then the, yes?
Where does he get his Buddhist model? It's a caricature that I don't
he cites a Buddhist author in here. I don't recall the name right now. I'll check on that and get you the name if you'd like to find the title.
My concept is there up in the mountains, the begging of the Buddhists who have attained it is to escape work and not to go into the valleys other than to gouge those who are in the capacity to fill the walls.
Yes, this surprised me too, because I had the same notion. But he does take his these principles from a Buddhist author. So there may be two points of view among the Buddhists for that matter, but he attributes much of the tranquility of the Buddhist society to this notion of work.
That may be the difference in terms of the ultimate goal of the Buddhist. Not to say that how they live their life on the way to this, I don't know what that is, isn't it their state and then nirvana, whatever, they're working toward a goal. And once you get there, then that may be true that then you don't have to work anymore. Mm-hmm. Except maybe you do,
yes,
in the sense that you have to still pick the apples.
Well, there is, of course.
You have to just do what is necessary for existence, and for bodily existence, but that's all the work that you have to do.
He mentions elsewhere the balance between work and leisure in the Buddhist society. It might be that when the Buddhist does work, as some of them must do, that these principles apply. And when they are enjoying their leisure, then this other aspect comes more into dominance.
Isn't the elimination of desire critical to Buddhism?
What's that?
The elimination of desire.
Yes, that's right, yes, right, yeah, right.
So that would tie in.
Yeah. The Buddhist is not constantly seeking to draw to himself increasing wealth. He has cut the root of that desire. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes, yeah. I'm not familiar enough with Buddhism, but it would be good to read through a little bit of Buddhism before one looks at this book more carefully.
Is there another point to
that? Yes. The third one is that the production of goods obviously is needed for satisfying existence. Yes. The third one is that the production of goods obviously is needed for satisfying existence. But that's the last of the three. Someplace recently I read that people in the U.S. today are placing a stronger greater value on security than they are on the amount of their paycheck. This was the result of some recent survey among college students, I think, looking for jobs now. They were placing a higher value on security than they were on the size of the paycheck. Yes.
King James Version says, take no thought for the morrow. But then in the Proverbs it says, move the ant, thou sluggard, because she gathers her winter food in
yes.
the summertime. She takes not a thought for the morrow.
Yes, yeah. Another interesting paradox in the scriptures. Well, I found very refreshing this emphasis upon the enlivening and rejuvenating aspect of work in the person's life. It places a strong emphasis upon that, and I think myself that that's a very important thing to capture and retain in our society. I don't think that leisure has any meaning except as it's set aside work. And likewise, work has no meaning if there's no leisure. Somehow one must strike a balance between the two, and the two must nurture one another. But complete leisure, which some people idolize and see as an ideal, to me is folly, because the leisure would become very quickly, I think, a meaningless kind of experience. He also takes on John Kenneth Galbraith, who one time said, if we can afford some unemployment in the interest of stability, then we can afford to give the unemployed goods that enable sustaining of accustomed standards of living. Well, that's the supporting of unbounded leisure, you see, on the part of those who are unemployed. But Schumacher says that the Buddhist would see this as standing truth on its head. And
he's right in the one sense. That's true. The unemployment system fosters that. And yet if you look at, let's say, the people that maybe get accused anyway, rightly or wrongly, of abusing mm-hmm. the unemployment system, let's say like Boeing engineers, when they all got laid off, a certain number of them, you could say, just decided, well, I'm going to take my employment and enjoy my time and go back.
Yes, yeah.
Which I'm sure some did. But most of those people, they didn't continue to do that. I mean, you know, what? I mean, that, and not necessarily just because they ran out of money.
Mm-hmm.
They needed these other things that you're pointing out, that he points out, you know, that you need out of work. And so sooner or later they went back into it.
Uh-huh.
So I don't think that necessarily the whole unemployment system, as Galbraith maybe, or other current economists have perceived it, necessarily is going to foster unlimited leisure as their goal.
Yes, well, I'm not enough of an economist to analyze Galbraith's statement or the unemployment issue carefully, but yeah, I suspect what you say is correct.
On the other hand, when a society has certain people who they never employ, I mean, they never make a position somehow.
For
the society doesn't to employ those hardcore unemployed, whatever they are, there's something bad because you're denying those people those mm-hmm. needs or fulfillment of those needs that he's pointing out here. And I guess that's, maybe we're not really grappling with that issue in terms of how we're just looking at the statistics of how many unemployed there are, you know, at a particular moment in time, rather than who are those unemployed. Some of those unemployed are people who need the period of unemployment, because it's the only way they can get leisure.
Well, that's right. You could regard...
If they quit work entirely for 6 months, or a year or two, in order to ever get any leisure, then they go back into working themselves to death for 5 years, and then they have to have unemployment.
They prefer their leisure in different package than most of us, perhaps. That's certainly possible. Yeah.
And then they get out of work.
Yes.
And then people at the retirement, it's the same business, this forced retirement at a certain age is denying people those fulfillment of those needs after they reach an arbitrary age of 65. And then they're saying you can't have those needs fulfilled anymore. Ridiculous. They should give them more free time when they're 30 or 45.
Yes, you had.
Well, if you treat California as a nation and not a state, it's the fifth most productive nation in the world. And one would have to ask the question that leads into this article, I think it's important, for example, of its leadership. Why would a former Jesuit seminarian, who is now a Zen existentialist and presently the governor of California, who sleeps on a mattress and abstains from using the new Reagan mansion, why would this governor become interested in and advocate until the recent success of the space shuttle vehicle enterprise, advocate and be interested in Schumacher's book, Small is Beautiful, and shortly after when the enterprise successfully launched for 5-minute trial, begin to talk about bigness again? I mean, what is it about life in the fifth most productive, most developed, advanced nation in the world, California? What is unfulfilling about life? What is scary about life? What is going on in the lifestyle of Californians that causes these directions in leadership and people who are leading and trying to find answers in California? Californians have been the subject of 4 recent popular journal articles concerning this same theme, small is beautiful. Something, and in California, the dream is off. Start to think, what is happening that's causing people like Brown and others to examine this proposition? I wonder what it is. What's missing in the Californian lifestyle? What's happening?
It's not that something's missing, it may be that there's something there that you're looking to get rid of. Or both. But I don't know that it has to be rich and looking for something.
Well, hasn't the economy not, hasn't it fulfilled the prophecy of the Southern California real estate boomers that caused people to come there? Hasn't it fulfilled its promise? Nothing but sun? In sauna without sauna, hasn't it? Haven't they turned? Isn't this? I'm curious. Where are they in their self-fulfilled prosperity? They lack direction. Where do they go? What is the function of the new religions? This is a kind of a new religious sect appeal, isn't it? There's a lot of other religious movements available and going, growing in California, isn't there? A lot of escapism into environmentalism, into the Mojave and the motorbike, too, isn't there? Now, why? Now, what's happened in California that and the other areas like the Northwest, where scenery eaters come to live, what are we on the brink of? What are we about ready to fulfill that we don't want to be a part of? I mean, we've, you know, people have heard, I've listened to people here today, and they want their cake and eat it too. You want Holden Village, but you couldn't have had Holden Village unless a prior economic experience had taken place here. What don't you want? What I'd like to hear from you now is, what does Schumacher say about this, you know, what kind of a lifestyle does he see that he would like to see us evolve into, an economic lifestyle?
Ultimately, he would like to see developed what he calls an intermediate technology, one that is a technology in the full sense of the word, but is not so monstrous and huge that he claims present technology is. He claims we can survive very well with a less permeating and less overwhelming technology. And along that line, I brought along an article from Smithsonian, which had an article by Wilson Clark on big and or little, the search for right technology, and it really is right down the line of what Schumacher has been saying. And there are a number of examples in here of ways in which the Western world has tried to help developing nations, for example, and have brought to these nations a technology that is overwhelming for those countries, and ultimately have not helped them. And Schumacher says that we must just tone this down a little bit and make it fit like the sensible shoe. So it's not that he's trying to eliminate technology at all, but rather he says that it has become too large for our use, and that it's become a kind of a game and a plaything that we just continually expand and extend with no real purpose in mind. We don't we build bigger things without the reason for building them. And we,
who says that? We build bigger things without any purpose?
Well, that's Schumacher's claim.
Okay, well, how innovative have the English been in terms of getting involved with planning and changing their economy and providing a humanistic orientation?
Well,
what is the state of their humanizing their technology?
Well, Schumacher claims that England is more humanizing than U.S. or Germany. He says if you travel from Germany and the U.S., which are highly industrialized, to England, you will sense a more calm state of mind among the people. He says the Germans and people in the U.S. are much more frenetic about their life. They pursue things with a vengeance. And the British have a little more time to relax and stop and think and have tea. And he calls that a virtue. Now, maybe some people wouldn't, but he does.
Why can Schumacher get away with that? And
why not?
Well, because he draws on a particular vision of England. England's still a class-driven society.
Yeah.
England is still rigid. England is still deeply divided.
I don't think he's denying it. I think he would agree with you. But he's taking the question of technology in particular. And I think he's looking around at that aspect. You know, he's not claiming England is a perfect society. And he's looking around and seeing many of the absurdities of the technology. And I think he's saying in that regard that maybe England has, we may be able to learn something from England. but I think maybe some of the, even some of the newer third world countries may be able to learn something.
What can we learn from
England? Well, I don't know that much about England, so I mean, if you want me to tell you some of the other cultures I've been to, we can learn things from. I'll be glad to do that.
Now, Schumacher, I mean, you know, what can we learn from England? About what?
He says you can learn in terms of taking time, in terms of big technology, that seems somehow they have not gotten along quite into the big technology that we have. And California, and Southern California in particular, would be a good example. He raises that issue, that is it really good to have all that big technology? He's saying he doesn't think it is, and he doesn't even think it's possible. I think we talk about writing a book small as necessary.
Yes, yeah.
A lot of big technology is
inside. This particular article by Wilson Clark cites the, well, it has a picture here in the, at the beginning, a modern tanker. And he says, there is no limit to the size that we can build tankers. We can build them larger and larger and larger. And he goes on to discuss some of the very extreme dangers that are inherent in this continual urge to bigness. And then goes from that into discussion of the blackout in New York and blames this on our disregard for this same question. That is, we enlarge our cities without bounds. We allow cities to become, to have populations of 7, 8, 10 million people or more. And then we expect all to function well. And then when we have some kind of a small failure in the power system, we have a catastrophe. And this, he says, we could avoid if we did not always have this urge to bigness. And
have we, in fact, been enlarging the boundaries of our cities? The answer is no, we haven't. What we have been allowing ourselves to do is we've been allowing our cities to be restricted and allow the population to move outside of the boundaries for narrow, selfish purposes, to avoid taxes, to move to suburbs, etc., etc. No. And we have left the poor in our cities.
Well, it's still a bigger city. You know,
define the city.
That people live in the bigger now. I don't care whether it's a suburb or a city.
Right.
You don't have the neighborhood plazas, you don't have the quarters like your old cities, you don't have those things. So you are part of the bigger community. And whether the political boundaries or not have moved out that far or not, is, you know, that's, I agree with you that the cities, the political boundaries are kept in by the suburbs, which are wealthier. And this ends up being a class kind of thing. But I think technology has made that possible. The automobile has probably done more in three ways to destroy a sense of community, a neighborhood community, than just about anything else we've got.
Yes.
I suspect that's also happening in England also, but maybe not quite as much as it has here.
Not nearly as much.
Yeah. I mean, they had many of the same problems. I don't think it's
well, it was because their land was so restricted to begin with. And they set down very strict contingencies on that, okay, ostensibly not because of the suburbs they were actually. That's what the biggest problem in California is. The single biggest problem that has to do with that. There's no sense of community.
Well, our time is almost up. Any other reactions from the fringes here?
How politically is he going to do this? I mean, I can see his goal, and it seems very good, but how's he going to do it, actually, step by step? How would he suggest?
For one thing, he would urge a much stronger support of rural areas. He says that we need to stop this flow from the rural areas into the cities. The flow has been tremendous, he claims, and it has. And we've got to somehow stop this flow and hopefully reverse it and reestablish communities on the land and involve more people in direct production. Right now, he claims that only 3.5% of our total social time, as he calls it, take all the time available to all the people, and only 3.5% of that, maybe it's not that much, maybe that's a figure, is devoted to the task of production. And we have given prestige, or rather prestige is indirectly related, inversely related, to involvement in production. If you are involved directly in production, your prestige is low. The farther you are from production, the more prestigious your position. If you are an entertainer or a football star, your prestige is high. But if you work in a mine or in the field, till the soil, your prestige is low. And he feels this is an inversion of values, and that we ought to give more value to direct production.
It seems to me that the critical question relates to who makes the decisions to do that. And I can't help but think about, I think it was Mumford who characterizes the development of a technological society as going all the way back to Egyptian times, when you had the creation of a deity for purposes probably of manipulating society, and then the creation of the pyramid and so on was a consequence of that, and the creation of a mega-machine. Now look at who controls the Senate and the legislature, and who represent these interests. And I can't help but think that there's still an economic factor that has to do with wealth, that is egocentric, that has resulted in the society that we have. And it seems that we've got to address another kind of question, and that is how do you get to the point where you get the human satisfaction that people are searching for in holding, in aberrations in life as they live them, as attempts to get out into the suburbs, all sorts of reactions, it seems, are human questions. And it's a question, I think, of does society allow you to do what you want to do to be free, if you can define what you mean by being free? And are there elements that inevitably are going to control you because they control the decisions? The oil companies determine who's going to build the largest tankers. Who are the people in the legislature, you see, who make the decisions about whether we destroy our environment or potentially destroy our environment? And I think it's a question of the social system itself, and whether there is an inevitability about this tremendous weight of systems in our society that will preclude any real attainment of the freedom of thought.
I hear a vein here that says we have no control. We're being pushed in a particular direction, and we're just going to fall along with the tide.
I don't think that's true.
I don't think that's true. I don't think it should be true. We get what we ask for, and we get what we deserve in our government, in our treatment of our environment.
That's a little too simplistic.
Ultimately, I think it's true.
No, I don't think it is. It's true because that points it off to the individualism. And if you mean we as collectively as a people, then maybe there is something to that. What happens, you see, is each one of us has to live in an environment. And we each make a choice, and that choice is based upon the environment that we live in. But though collectively, all of those choices change the environment. And that's where we have the problem. So all of us might say, well, gee, it'd be nice to live in a place like Holden and not have to drive a car on a day-to-day basis. But we live in an environment where you have to have a car, so we buy a car.
What kind of car do you buy?
And all right, but let's just say we buy a small car, okay? We buy a small car, is dominated by a whole lot of cars, okay? And yet we all have to feel like we have to buy a car because the engineers have built all the freeways and the shopping centers are too far out to walk to.
And they try to build
all the cars.
So,
yeah.
Now, whose choice? Where's the choice?
Yeah, and I bought a big car so I wouldn't get hit in a little car by a big car.
Well, then it goes on that way. And that's how it escalates.
That's our show.
It escalates. But then what happens is, because the environment is changing, making more and more of these things necessary for you to survive, so you pick them, you end up having more needs at the end of, let's say, a decade than you had at the beginning, but you're not better off. You don't have more freedom.
That's what we're talking about. That's exactly.
The transportation system we have in this country is one of the most inefficient that's ever been imagined. And we spend more time traveling.
And we are there because of our own greed, avarice, and our own choice.
Our inability to deal collectively with our choice.
That's
one of the
factors.
there are two parts of that.
That's my father.
Choice and
that's my father's simplistic solution.
You can make a choice not to get involved, but you also make a choice not to survive economically.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, where do you make that balance?
You know, we also live in a big planet. Might mean that mind if I explain why we have to move around and have to do big things. We have a bigger what I get concerned about is why does everybody get upset with the fact that I know that there's a finiteness to our resources on planet Earth, but why do all of a sudden do we start developing attitudes like they're running out in 15 minutes? I mean, like,
No one's saying they're running out in 15 minutes. I don't think that's it. But when I hear Kissinger, for example, say, well, we may have to go to war to support our lifestyle, and I see people driving big cars, and I've got two sons that are 9 years old, and I look at the projections for world resources, 10 years to spend that, then I say, now's the time to speak up. And
nobody's saying throw all the cars out. It's not pumping or anything. Tomorrow you can't. No, I don't think most people understand that. But you have to start some ways. I mean, it's like the SST thing. I mean, that was a great example of, it really at least it brought society into facing the issue of technology. You know, whether it's right or wrong in terms of deciding whether we need it or should let it land. It's irrelevant, but at least it, made everybody stop and think, is this in fact the kind of technology that we want? What he said, if you're useful to him, is saying, is the ultimate result of it ridiculous or not? And that's a very good question. We should ask that question much more often than many things.
See, maybe we're ascribing values to technology, which are really the consequence of human use of technology.
Yes, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Try that question. Versus expending that same amount of money for an educational system or developing ways for people to get together, it would be an entirely different world.
Right, yeah.
And so, we're not saying that inherently technology is bad. We've all profited by it.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, medicine and a host of good enterprises profit from.